finish it.
We don't want to hear what he has to say.
Okay.
Ready. House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order, and today our first order of business is the revenue forecast. Paul, you want to say anything, or should we just bring up?
Madam Chair, I think we have our presenters here from the Office of Economic Analysis. This is the December forecast.
Presenters, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark McMullen with the Office of Economic Analysis, joined by my colleague, Josh Lehner. We'll be giving our outlook today. Since we last met in August, the revenue forecast, as well as the underlying economic forecast, have tracked very closely to what we've seen in terms of our collections and job growth and the like. So as a result, this round of forecast has not changed a whole lot. But that said, unchanged does not mean flat by any means. In fact, we've had acceleration built into the next couple of years in our forecast for quite some time. We expect growth to pick up a little bit in fiscal year 2014 and 2015, not in the very near term. There are too many weights on the economy in the very near term. But going forward, we expect to see a little bit better growth, not anything like what we've become accustomed to in past periods of economic recovery in Oregon, unfortunately, but a little bit better than what we've seen over the past couple of years. But it's unlikely that we'll see a whole lot in the very near term. Very few economists are bullish about the beginning of 2013. There are a couple of weights on the economy. For one, orders going forward for durable goods and a lot of manufactured products are very weak. And so we expect shipments to drop accordingly going forward. And that, you know, is particularly important for Oregon and its large traded sector. And the second large issue is the amount of uncertainty in the economy, particularly surrounding federal fiscal policy. Many businesses right now are taking a wait-and-see attitude before, you know, sticking their neck out with large investments and hiring. And as a result, we don't expect to see much early on in the year, as well as, you know, when we layer on top the potential contractionary impact of cutting back on federal government spending and increasing federal taxes could further slow growth. So the beginning of next year is probably going to be soft and continue to be frustrating. But after that, we have some hope that things will get better, and this has been baked into our cake for some time. In terms of the nature of growth, we're really not seeing much change over the past 6 to 12 months. We've seen really slow growth at the economic, at the U.S. level. But that said, the drivers of this growth and the composition of this growth are changing quite a bit. What's happened is consumers have really taken over and started driving and taken away from businesses and traded firms who have really been leading the recovery to date. But manufacturers and other traded sector industries tend to be very volatile, and they swing a lot in the business cycle. They boom and they bust. And we've had a couple of years of strong growth among manufacturers, and not surprisingly, they're cooling off now. But just in time, luckily, we're seeing households start to spend. Households are now becoming very confident in terms of measures of consumer sentiment, and they're starting to spend more on autos, and in particular on housing. We're finally seeing some recovery in our housing market. So while the composition of growth has changed, the speed has not. We're still looking at a disappointingly lackluster recovery. Now, over the business cycle as a whole, we still expect consumers to somewhat drag on growth, particularly when compared with historical periods of growth in Oregon, because consumers still need to save more. But in the near term, they're doing a lot of work for us, and this is welcome. So why do we feel that we're going to see more growth once we get through this soft period of the next few months? Well, the fundamentals underlying the economy are very strong. In particular, while, as I mentioned, households do need to save more over the long term, right now their current balance sheets are in great shape, as are the balance sheets of businesses. We have, in terms of households, if we look at delinquency rates on a wide range of credit instruments, from student loans and auto loans and credit cards and the like, all of these delinquency rates are near record lows. In fact, even mortgage debt, when we're talking about one or two payments late, 30 days or 60 day delinquent, these are extremely low right now as well. The only place we still see stress, not surprisingly, are in these 90 plus day delinquent mortgages and the like, where we're still seeing some hangover from the housing crisis and the mortgage crisis. But in general, consumers now, you know, have gotten their near-term financial house in order, and that gives them some ability to spend. But the and in terms of businesses, we're seeing even better credit conditions or even stronger balance sheets. The first chart I have up here shows corporate profits as a share of GDP. And that's, of course, the first element we need for businesses want to expand is they have to see money out there. They have to see the potential for profit so that if they expand their operations by hiring and investing, they'll make more of it. And eventually, of course, this brings down prices and down profits as well. This is our profit cycle. But right now, we're just about as high as we were in terms of the profits as a share of the economy as in the housing boom, when we know we got quite a bit of investment at that time. The next element is not whether or not, you know, firms can make money if they expand, but whether or not they have the resources with which to do so. And early on in our recovery, this was clearly short-circuiting some of our growth insofar as we had a banking crisis, particularly among smaller banks, and firms didn't have the resources with which to expand their operations. But right now, given that there are so few profitable investments out there, and the ones that are out there, as we saw before, businesses are very afraid and taking a wait-and-see attitude right now. They've amassed quite a bit of cash. All these profits without expansion equals a lot of cash on hand. And so so businesses, and particularly large businesses, do have the wherewithal if they do get the courage to invest and to expand. It's there. They have the money. They're making the profits. So we think that there is quite a bit of potential growth and potential improvement should this be unleashed. But unfortunately, we don't see this happening again in the next couple of 3 months. And again, a large reason for our pessimism is the new orders data, where we've seen a real sharp decline, which suggests that sales and production will decline and be soft as well going forward in the near term. So how does this translate into Oregon? Well, Oregon is really appears to be following along with the rest of the U.S. in terms of the slow, steady growth we're seeing, about half the rate of what a typical expansion would be. When we look at coincident indices, index components, these are bits of data that are supposed to tell us about what's happening right now in Oregon's economy. You'll see most of them. This is employment, hours worked in manufacturing, unemployment rate, and wages and salaries. And for the most part, they're all slowly getting better. But that improvement seems to have really stalled, aside from hours worked in manufacturing, which some people believe is more of a leading indicator than a coincident one. But for all these others, employment, unemployment rate, and real wages and salaries, the trend is still upward, but the last few months have been soft. And I think that has been confirmed in our revenue data as well, that I think we've certainly seen a slowdown in growth over the last couple of months. It's hard to tell from the most timely indicators we have are the payroll job numbers, and unfortunately from these right now they're subject to a lot of revision, and it's difficult to really tell what is happening. For our revenue models, we go with a less timely but more complete and accurate survey of employment, which is, you see here the blue line on the top would be the index of employment based on the covered employment and wages, which is basically everyone in the unemployment insurance records. This is great because this data is not subject to being benchmarked, in other words, changed. In fact, this is what's used to adjust the dotted blue line below, which is what we're seeing in our monthly monthly employment statistics, which is telling quite a different story. but unfortunately, the downside to this is that we do not get very timely data. We do not have the last 2 or 3 months in terms of this more accurate employment data that we use with which to base our revenue forecast. And if the payroll survey and what we're seeing in terms of withholding out of personal income taxes, out of wages and salaries, if those are any guide, we know the last couple of months have not been particularly good for Oregon. If anything, flat at best. Again, I won't go through all the economy facts. Again, the recent employment numbers are a little bit misleading in terms of our rankings across states. As you saw from the earlier graph, once the revisions kick in, our ranking will go up quite a bit. But what is true from the broader data is that we are seeing, again, subpar growth. 3% and 4% income growth is hardly what we've become accustomed to. And in particular, we have a concern here that we see exports starting to fall and weaken or grow slowly in the case of our manufactured products, our non-tech manufactured products. This is a problem. Our growth in exports it places us among the bottom across all states, and not unexpected given our strong ties to Asia and how much Asian demand has slowed in recent months. But this is clearly on our radar as a major risk, and it also is part of the dynamic that's happening where we're seeing less growth from our businesses and more growth from our consumers. So looking forward, Josh is going to talk a little bit about the leading indicators that we look at to try to give us a hint going forward without using our formal models.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And that's right, I just want to take a quick look at some of the leading indicators we see here in Oregon that we use as part of our forecasting process. In the state, we have two different leading indicator series. They're the bottom two lines on this graph. The blue line is the series that's produced out of our office, and the red line is the University of Oregon Index of Economic Indicators that is produced out of the University of Oregon. And they're both basically telling the same story right now. That's basically flat in the past 3 or 4 months. Ours took a big step down in June. That was sort of a one-time, all of the various underlying economic indicators took a downshift in their values, but then it's kind of steadied off since then. The University of Oregon Index has been fairly steady in the last 3, 4, 6 months as well. And basically, you can divide the underlying components into two groups. You have the manufacturing components, the good producing components. Those are all down at the moment, to flat at best, but most likely down. And then you have the consumer side and the employment side more generally. Those seem to be doing pretty well at the moment. So you combine all those together, and that's where you get this sort of flat nature. On the production side, you have industrial production at the U.S. level has been flat basically all year, with Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy hitting the East Coast in the most recent months. That's actually taken a step back in September and October data. Well, September was down, and then the October data was just come out. That was down partially due to the storm. The Purchasing Managers Index for manufacturing has been negative throughout the summer months, but it's just back a little bit in the positive territory recently. Air freight shipments out of the PDX airport, those have been flat for the past 6 months or so. So really we're seeing these production goods indices flat to down, and that's what's weighing on these leading growth indicators, because a lot of production and jobs and the traded sector are very important for the local economy. On the other side, on the plus side, you have the consumers. Consumer sentiment has rebounded to levels not seen since before the recession itself. For a while, retail sales and some consumer spending has picked up the last couple months, but consumer sentiment hasn't. It's been lagging. So people started spending more, even though they say they don't feel better about the economy. Well, now they're saying they're feeling a lot better about the economy, and it's kind of matching where their spending's been the last couple years. So that's good news. Withholding continues to grow, certainly on a year-over-year basis in the state. and claims for new claims for unemployment insurance are certainly at good levels, or at least expansionary levels. You can see from this graph, this is just the level of claims adjusted for the size of the economy effectively. And we're back to levels seen during the 1990s expansion. We've been there for a few months now, and almost all the way back to things we saw in 2006 at the sort of the height of the growth rates we saw in the previous expansion. So this is good news in the sense that we have reached expansionary levels of firing, if you will, that the level of layoffs in the economy are down to normal levels. The flip side of this that we don't have as good of data on is the hiring rate. So the firing rate is down, but the hiring rate's not quite back to what we've seen. So the net employment gains continue to be relatively small. But so long as the new claims remain down, we think that's a good sign for growth moving forward. If this starts to pick back up, it's a leading indicator of employment losses and recessions and whatnot. So that's sort of, we have the dichotomy between the production stuff is down, but the consumer spending and the broader economic trends are up. So that leads to the flat leading indicators at this point in time.
Thanks, Josh. I wanted to make a couple of quick comments about manufacturing. Manufacturing and our mix of manufacturers in this state is really one of the comparative advantages Oregon has going forward in this recovery. There are really two reasons we expect the state to perform a little bit better than the U.S. as a whole. One is manufacturers and the broader producers of goods, and the second would be Oregon's proven ability to attract new households to the state. Once the housing market is not short-circuited, we should see these migration flows come into Oregon once more. The manufacturing really represents, our biggest curse as well as our biggest blessing in this state, our exposure to manufacturing. It's an old story what's happened to manufacturers in Oregon and across the U.S. This is just overall manufacturing employment. You see here that Oregon is back down to the level it was in the early 70s. And as a share of overall employment, it's gone from a third of the overall workforce after World War II to roughly 10% now. And this is a familiar story: rapid technological change, globalization, and the productivity enhancements, of course, that allow us to make a whole lot more product with fewer workers. Now, that said, while manufacturing has become a smaller and smaller part of the Oregon workforce, it certainly hasn't in terms of output and the product. And relative to other states, Oregon is doing well, as it typically does in good times and bad. This chart, instead of just looking at manufacturing employment, is looking at manufacturing employment in Oregon as a share of the overall U.S., in which case we've continued to make strides over the last couple of decades. Why? Well, one is our comparative advantages. Manufacturers here, you have very relatively cheap supply of skilled labor. They have inexpensive electricity, mineral-free water. The location between major markets in California, Asia, and Vancouver is advantageous. And so it's a good place to do business. And secondly, it isn't tied to a lot of the old line manufacturers. Unlike some of the Rust Belt states, we don't have a bunch of old auto part plants here. We don't have old textile factories that they do in the South, which have been taking losses at an even faster rate than our relatively modern manufacturers. So this is good news, and we've had a little bit of news, in terms of the expansion in Washington County over the last couple of months that's also very encouraging, and we added a little bit to the forecast for that. And the next real true reason for optimism, I think, going forward is the long-awaited return of some growth in housing-related industries, and Josh is going to say a few words about those.
That's right. The housing recovery is here. It's still in its sort of infant stages, but we are starting to see increases in production, increases in prices, increases of sales, all the level activities that you like to see, and certainly we're seeing on the employment side as well with housing-related employment increasing, construction workers, mortgage brokers, realtors, your home improvement stores, things like that. You combine all those employment series together, we're starting to see some job gains in the past year or two, which is good news. And this first item I had here is just trying to try and dissect what the housing recovery looks like. And this has sort of been in place for a couple of years now, but you really needed a spark to sort of set this off because we had an oversupply of homes. Part of that's the foreclosures. and the delinquents and the short sales, and there's a whole lot of supply issues. But as the prices have come down, we really just needed a spark to set off this housing recovery, and that sort of comes from employment or population growth. You basically need to have more people with jobs. They have more income. That increases demand. They can go out and sign a lease on a new apartment or buy a home. The same thing with population growth. During the recession, we saw record levels of families and individuals doubling up, tripling up in the same housing unit, whether that's a home or an apartment. And eventually that just becomes a little, you can only stretch the number of inhabitants in a housing unit so far before you have to go out and start signing more leases and buying homes. So really we just needed that spark, and we've sort of seen the slow and steady employment gains, and that's contributing to this, but also the population growth over the last few years of 1%, a little less here in Oregon per year, is really increasing the number of people, so that increases the demand and sort of sets off this self-reinforcing cycle of increased demand and increased production and the like. And so this is sort of just a very simple flow chart of how that sort of takes place. And in Oregon, what we're seeing in terms of new home construction, this is actually housing permits. The bottom level is single-family homes. The lighter blue area is multifamily homes. You can see it's going up sharply to the right there at the end, at the far right of the graph. It's going up and to the right. Those are the types of lines you like to see in terms of economic activity. We're seeing some very impressive growth rates, 40-50% on a year-over-year basis. A lot of that's in the multifamily market at this point in time, but single-family is coming back as well. And so the growth rates look very, very impressive at this point in time, but you can see it's from a very low base. The recession took a big toll on the housing sector, and we're just now starting to come off the mat a little bit. So moving forward, this is a good news. The U.S. has never fallen. You know, there's some. If you look at the historical data, the U.S. has never fallen into recession when housing's on the upswing. That doesn't mean it can't happen, but the fact that housing's turned around a little bit is certainly encouraging for growth rates moving forward in the economic outlook.
So quickly, before we move on to the revenue picture, I just wanted to touch on a couple of risks to the outlook. The largest one keeping me up at night would be the slowdown, particularly in Asia. Here we see Oregon's export growth down almost 10% to the Eurozone and 20% to our largest trading partners, China and Malaysia here, year over year, 2012 to date. Obviously, the Asian financial crisis in the 1990s taught us a painful lesson about how important this is for Oregon's economic growth. And fortunately or unfortunately, we have a lot more ties to Asia now than we did at that time. So any significant downturn in Asia would you know, have the potential to derail our recovery. The other risk that's, of course, broadly talked about out there is the so-called fiscal cliff. Here are some numbers. The upshot really is that no matter which vendor, this is our vendor, Global Insight, but most all of the macroeconomic shops are looking at somewhere around a 3-4% drag on GDP if we went ahead with everything that was included in the sequester plan now. What does this mean for our revenue outlook? Well, the largest implication of this, or the largest risk for this, is the risk of the underlying economic recovery. When we're growing at a roughly 2% year gains in GDP, the thought of taking 3-4% away is a scary one. So the most direct way, or the most likely way, that this will significantly impact the state budget would be through the economy, through creating a nationwide recession, which Oregon will always share in, and our revenues would fall accordingly. In terms of our direct impacts on our revenues, it's less clear. We have some factors which would suggest that that revenues would increase as a result of these actions. In particular, if you get rid of deductions, for example, the AMT fix, to the extent that Oregon piggybacks on federal income determination, well, more taxable income on the federal level will mean more taxable income at the Oregon level. But at the same time, Oregonians take credit for federal taxes paid on their income taxes. And so this will be a factor that would suggest that Oregon's revenues are going to go down. But on net, it's not going to be a large change directly one way or the other. Some states have a little bit more connection, those that don't have estate taxes and the like. Another way that we're factoring this into the forecast has to do with behavioral responses to tax cuts or increases. In particular, our baseline forecast right now assumes that the Bush-era tax rates for those households making over $250,000 a year are allowed to expire. And the impact on our forecast of this is that households that expect their tax rate to go up will pull forward some investment income or capital gains into the current period in anticipation of these increases. And whether or not federal policymakers do allow these tax rates to go up, broadly now, accountants and tax professionals are giving the advice to their wealthy clients to go ahead and pull forward these gains just in case. And so in terms of one of the impacts on our revenue forecast is a timing issue, that the expectation of these tax increases is bringing more payments into April of 2013 and out of the future years. And that said, it also highlights a risk. If we see a huge April 2013 in terms of collections, it would suggest that this dynamic is very strong and would lead us to reduce the forecast for the next biennium in terms of April 2014 and April 2015, and payments we'll see then. This chart kind of shows why they're going through the fiscal cliff, why they're suffering. In terms of, again, our primary risk is whether or not their actions or federal policymakers' actions will lead to a nationwide recession or at least curb growth significantly. And that's the trick. You know, how do we tighten budgets, as we obviously have to do, without hurting growth? Because a chart like this, where we look at the debt as a share of GDP, you really can't improve this in any real way if you don't have the GDP growing as well. If we don't have some kind of growth in the economy, it's going to be really difficult to improve the situation whatsoever. But that said, we should get pretty close. These two alternatives, we see the blue line is the baseline, which in CBO is current law, which would say all the sequester goes ahead and kicks in and everything that's planned happens. And the red line is just the opposite, saying, well, all those things that we say are going to kick in, what if we just ignore it and let it continue as it is today in terms of the AMT fixes and payroll tax cuts and the like? As you see, there's quite a different picture in terms of the outcome. I think there's still a relatively high probability that we'll avoid the worst scenarios here. When we look at the plans that have been kicked around in Washington, the Simpson-Bowles and the Gang of Six stuff, this is pretty close to the blue CBO baseline. They depend on some vague, you know, assumed cost savings and whatnot in the plans, but that's not highly unusual. So I think it's likely that we'll get some sort of orderly resolution to this, and in which case it shouldn't slow growth beyond the next few months. So the upshot for the economic recovery is that we are going to expect some more growth. Here we see, since the bottom in 2009, our jobs in Oregon have grown at roughly 2% a year annualized rate, and now we see that going up to 2.5 or 2.6% a year over the next couple of years. Again, this is quite a bit weaker than we're accustomed to. In a typical or the average expansion, we're looking at more like 3% growth in terms of employment. But it's significantly better, or noticeably better, than we've had so far. Here's how it kind of looks relative to the last three business cycles, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. The dark blue line is employment growth over those expansions, 4% in the 80s, 3% in the 90s, 2.5% in the 2000s, a bad trend, and to date, less than 2% so far this time around. And that's compared against the best 2 years of the expansion, which in our forecast are the net, are fiscal 2014 or 2015 or calendar 2014 or 2015, roughly. In this case, it's we've compared the red line there as actually the next biennium, it's fiscal 2014 and 2015, which is about when we hit our peak of growth. But as you see here, it'll be a disappointing one relative to past recoveries, even though we do expect to see some improvement.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Before we move on, Representative Berger has a couple questions.
Yes, gentlemen, you don't necessarily have to respond, but a couple of things I'm curious as you've considered in your forecasting for Oregon. One is I have heard it said that I've lived through the dot-com bubble and then the housing bubble, and what I hear coming is the school debt bubble. All these folks who have gone to school assume this massive debt, and I guess the question then is, how does that affect Oregon, and is it considered in your forecast, and do you see it as a problem? And the other question that I have is your discussion of exports and manufacturing, two critical things that have helped Oregon get out of, you know, be ahead coming out of this, is all good, and you're saying it's slowing down, and then right before us is the possibility of a port shutdown and its effect on that. So those are the two questions I wonder if you'd give us a glance at, because I'm unfortunately going to have to leave before the rest of the presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to.
Thank you. Well, quickly, in terms of the school debt bubble, what's really important is to the extent to which school or education improves your productive capacity. Right now, there's a huge difference in your expected earnings with a degree and without one. And to a large extent, that will, you know, pay for whatever debt is incurred. Now, unlike, say, for example, your housing bubble or your tech, but the housing bubble, you say, oh, well, goodness, we have all this house price appreciation. House prices keep going up. I can take all this debt and I'll just sell it 2 years from now and make more money.
Didn't work out that
way. It didn't work out that well. The way there wasn't necessarily the productive capacity. With education, you could argue that you're getting something of value. You're getting something that would make someone more productive, either through signaling that they're a productive worker or through giving them skills in the workforce. If that's the case, if you're getting actually useful economic skills, it's not necessarily a bad thing to take out a whole lot of debt, particularly at the price right now in terms of low interest rates. But the numbers are big, and so it is certainly a concern, but it has not been directly factored into our forecast to date. The port shutdown, it also, of course, is a large concern. Anything that's extended there could certainly derail some of our growth. As long as it's a temporary disruption and we don't lose any shippers or we don't lose any, you know, manufacturing expansions as a result of their fear that they can't move their goods, we'll be okay. As long as it's short term, it should just be a disruption and not a disaster. But that said, since we're depending so heavily on our traded sector, any threat there is a big one.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to get.
Let's move on. We'll welcome you back when you come, Representative Berger.
All right. So the revenue picture. Again, as I mentioned in the opening comments, the revenue collections are very closely matching the forecast we put out in August. Unfortunately, that's not a very robust forecast. Here we see personal income taxes growing at roughly 5% rate. The bad number in September is not much of a concern. It had more to do with a huge extra payment we got last September than any weakness this year. It just compared to last year, there was no growth. But we're looking at roughly, you know, 5% growth, which for Oregon's income taxes is not very impressive. And more of a concern is the mix. We're really seeing a slowdown and some weakness in our labor-related income. The withholdings out of wages and salaries have become progressively weaker over the last couple of months, which suggests weaker gains in the job market. For corporate collections, we haven't seen a whole lot either, which is can be a bit of a concern given the traditional volatility and boom bust we see in both the underlying profits and corporate collections. And as we saw early, profits are very high right now as a share of output, and it's possible that they could contract. And you know, given the history, this series will contract or double in a matter of months. And so even things have been so calm right now, but even so, we're not entirely out of the woods in terms of a corporate kicker. We'll know better. We get the big payment in December. But, you know, if we get the kind of boom that we've seen in the past, that we saw here early in 2011, a 50% increase, but a year ago before that we saw 200% increases. Something along those lines will put us in line to go over the kicker threshold, which right now we have about 56 or 57 million away. Till the end of the biennium, we have about, according to this forecast, we have, I think, roughly 270 million left to get in. So if it's running 25-30% ahead, we could get into that neighborhood. But the other concern here is that there is some downside risk, particularly with respect to some cases being adjudicated right now that are trying to determine what counts as organ sales or whether or not it's appropriate to use a single sales factor. Some of these risks are quite big and could hit the forecast on the order of $100 million, given the way these cases are resolved. So now I also wanted to have, Josh is going to take a couple comments about some smaller tax items. They're smaller in terms of the impact on the general fund, but there are some interesting policy implications right now for this group, so I thought it would be worth the time.
Thank you. Yeah, in a lot of times we don't talk about some of these smaller tax line items in the general fund just because personal income taxes and corporate income taxes by far dominate the discussion and move the forecast around. But right now we have a couple interesting scenarios playing out, particularly regarding the border tax effect. That's basically when you have two different jurisdictions that have different tax rates or different tax structures, and you kind of create this tax differential right along, you know, a geographical or political border. And first up is cigarette sales. These are just packs sold in the state of Washington versus packs sold in the state of Oregon. On the left axis and the right axis is the tax rate differential in dollar terms between the state levy taxes on a pack of cigarettes. Basically, the overall pattern that you can see here is that when Washington raises their tax rate and Oregon does not follow immediately, Washington sales decline while Oregon sales sort of steady off and hold. The increase may be a little bit, or they steady off and hold flat. Both states have these long-term structural declines in the level of smoking, at least in the level of cigarette usage, tobacco usage. That's a big U.S. societal, actually it's an advanced world cultural trend that's been going on for decades at this point in time. And so you kind of see basically these movements around these structural trends. And right now the tax differential with Washington is at the highest it's been going back until, we have data back to 1980, that's what our model's based on. And you can see that they're now selling less packs than we are. Ours are holding kind of steady in the last couple of years since they last raised their taxes in 2010. Moving forward, we expect this sort of dynamic to continue. I know coming into legislative session, you guys get a lot of various bills associated with different sort of policies and taxes, so this is just something to keep in mind. It's a little bit interesting to see some of these border effects. And more recently, we have the...
Madam Chair.
Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. Just very quickly, is there any difference in the rate of utilization of cigarettes between Oregon and Washington?
No.
The percentage of people who smoke?
Mr. Chair, not at this point in time. The latest data I could see, the U.S. is somewhere around 20%. Washington, Oregon are like 18-19% of the adult population smokers. So a little bit less than the national, but the, you know, between the two states, it's about the same.
So this is a pretty pure tax play then that you're describing here?
It is a tax play, but then there's also other items, you know, such as the smoking cessation programs. You also have internet sales, tribal sales, things like that. So there are a lot of other components, but I would say particularly with our largest metropolitan area being right on the border, it provides an opportunity to arbitrage the tax rate differential a little bit.
Thank you.
And then here are liquor sales. It's a little bit something that's a little bit interesting, given the changes that Washington State has made to their liquor distribution system in recent months. This is basically the difference between border sales in Oregon and Idaho versus what's going on in Washington. You can see In Oregon, in the last couple of months, the sales have been up about 7-8% across the state. In Idaho, it's about 8 or 9%. But if you look at the specific stores closest to the border, they're up by 34% in Oregon and up by 28% in Idaho. And then in Washington itself, they're actually seeing 10% sales growth. And part of that has to do, they think, I was speaking with some of their economists up there, the novelty, right? You can buy your groceries and buy your liquor at the same time. So people are like, oh, I can pick up a bottle of something at the grocery store. So sales are up in the near term, but they think that'll go away. Those growth rates aren't quite as sustainable, but we're seeing quite a large border effect here in our state and also in Idaho as well. So I just wanted to highlight those because they're interesting to look at.
It sounds like overall consumption is going up with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other bright spot, if you will, in this is that consumers are stepping up in terms of their purchases. They're buying more expensive bottles, which you think would be a good sign of consumer income and the ability to spend. So part of this is not just the quantity, but also the quality, per se, is increasing. So that's some of the information I'm getting from some of the liquor stores around the state. So.
Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. Another measurement question. These percentages are based on volume, or are they based on dollar?
These are dollar sales.
Based on dollars.
Yes, sir.
So the fact that the price of liquor in Washington went up quite a bit would account for a big chunk of this.
Absolutely. That would be correct. That's the assumption that the price in Washington, based on an informal survey that OLCC did a couple months ago, it's 25 to 35% higher for the comparative bottles in Washington today than it is to Oregon today.
All right.
So that is driving some of these cross-border sales.
So if I could, Madam Chair, for example, the Warrenton number that shows up 33% may in fact be flat in terms of volume based on the numbers you just gave us. I'm looking at the wrong numbers, aren't I? These are Oregon numbers that we're looking at here.
Correct.
You haven't given us the Washington numbers.
Correct. That is correct. These are Oregon sales.
That helps clarify because, of course, there is no price difference change because of the Washington event in Oregon.
Correct.
Thank you. I was misreading the entire chart.
Okay. All right.
Okay, thanks. So on to the bottom line. Here is the outlook for the current biennium. We've seen a small increase, as you see here, over this is in terms of combined revenues, we're looking at roughly $40 million extra, which keeps us roughly where we were when the governor put together his recommended budget at this time 2 years ago. The most recent changes to our forecast you see here are somewhat higher, $40 million in this biennium, $63 million in the next biennium, and then the impact lowers as we lose this increase in personal income taxes. As you see here, 13-15 and 15-17, the gains here are driven by improvement in personal income tax collections. These personal income tax collections are up just due pretty much entirely to the economic outlook, where we have a little bit stronger job growth in that period, and then as we get later out into the out years, the job gains converge to what they were in September, and so too do the personal income tax collections. But those are offset by a couple of drags. Corporate income taxes, we've reduced the forecast again. Again, this is out of fear of a contraction. The longer that this profit boom goes on, the more concern about a bust we have on the other end. And then we also have some decline in other taxes. This has to do primarily with criminal fines and assessments. We've changed the distribution in our forecast, the distribution assumptions in keeping with the budget staff's needs. So that's been lowered as well. But on net, we see for the next three biennia, we have somewhat stronger revenue growth directly as a result of more personal income taxes, which in turn are a result of a somewhat stronger growth in wages and salaries underlying. But unfortunately, the impact on available resources is not quite as rosy. We have some subtractions, or rather diversions, that are going to start coming out of the general fund and reduce our ability to spend on other items. The two largest that we know about right now are come from one, House Bill 2707, which takes some of the additional corporate income tax that was associated with Measure 67 for firms with very high sales levels, and takes that tax money that's attributable to them and puts it into the rainy day fund. So that will be the green lines here. You see roughly a little bit over $40 million a year we expect to be transferred into the rainy day fund as a result of this corporate tax law. And the second offset we have here, ORS 285C, is the Strategic Investment Program, whereby the state sends some personal income tax money back to counties who had foregone property tax money in order to attract investment. They've given property tax breaks to firms that invest in the county, and then the state returns some personal income taxes that flow from that project back to the counties. And as you see here, we expect quite a bit of growth in this program on the order of 60 to $90 million over the next few biennium under current law. And as you see, $90 million in the next biennium, although it's very significant from a budgetary standpoint, as you see here, it's not a real qualitative difference in the personal income tax forecast. Personal income taxes are very large. You see the difference between the blue dotted line and the red line is almost hard to see. So qualitatively, we haven't really changed the forecast at all. But that said, again, it still calls for some acceleration. Corporate taxes have seen a qualitative reduction and are at risk of further reductions going forward, both because of this fear of a profit bust as well as concerns about action in the courts, which change our tax law. So there's, even though these are reduced significantly here, $20 million a year, I think the risk is still weighed to the downside for corporate income taxes. So in summary, our forecast for December, the $30.4 million is the big bottom line. That's net available resources. We see the revenue forecast is up slightly, largely because 2011 liability is coming in a bit higher than we expected or stronger than we expected now that we've got all the extended personal income tax returns in and we have a better idea of what people owed. Increased taxes by roughly $40 million, but then there was the offset for the strategic investment program, leaving the change in available resources to $30.4 million. Looking forward, this is the first forecast that's going to be used for 2013-2015 two-year budget process. The 10-year budget process is ongoing, but the two-year budget process is the first time the 13-15 forecast appears. And you'll see here it calls for just about $15.5 billion of available resources. That's $54 million higher than we expected. That's 54 higher than last September, in part due to the extra $30 million we're getting from last biennium that carries forward. So we're looking at, you know, on net we're gaining 23.6 in terms of an increase. So very small increase. The large increase in personal income taxes of $90 million is offset by a reduction in our forecast for corporate income taxes, for the criminal fines, and again for the strategic investment program. And finally, as has been the case for the last few forecasts, we see here that growth is not expected to improve going forward. In fact, stay well below what we've become accustomed to over the long run. The aging population in Oregon is going to slow both economic growth and underlying state revenue instruments are going to become weaker as a result. And so we can only expect in future biennia to grow around 10 or 12% a year, and even a biennium. And even in this most current biennium at 12%, unfortunately, that's still not enough to cover what our historical increases in the cost of providing government services are. So this forecast doesn't take off any more pressure. So with that, I'd love to open it up to questions.
Okay, questions from the committee. My goodness, this is a first. Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, is the reason for the potential downturn, the decline in some growth in the out years, you said that's related to population and demographic factors? Are there other factors that are that go into that forecast?
Yeah, well, predominantly the reason we're weaker really is the aging population. There are two things. It's the labor force participation rate, as we have fewer workers. Before, our growth has been fueled not only by households moving to Oregon, but also increased participation, particularly among women and minorities. And a lot of those things have played out, and now as we have an older aging population where a lot of very, very productive individuals are heading into retirement, this is going to put downward pressure on economic growth in general. And then layering on top of that, the fact that state tax instruments, personal income taxes and general sales taxes, personal income taxes depend on this prime working age cohort, and general sales taxes depend heavily on sales of big durable goods like cars and sofas and things that older individuals purchase less of. It would suggest that state revenue instruments are going to be even weaker than the underlying economy. So these are really the primary drivers of a weaker outlook.
Senator Telford.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So slow and steady appears what we're experiencing, which is better than declines. And in the past, you've kind of given us a percentage of potential risk of reentering a recession. Where are we on that?
Josh, do you know where our...
Senator Telfer, I believe the latest number that our vendor puts on is 25%. It's come down over the last year or two, certainly is up at 40% at one point in time. It's still uncomfortably high. Mm-hmm. However, you know, when they put a percentage on it, that's what it's currently at.
Okay. Right, other questions? Okay, well, committee, we're ahead of schedule, so we will give you 2 minutes extra on our break. So we will be in recess until 9:45. Okay, we will reconvene the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee and the House Revenue Committee, and we will now begin our discussion of the tax credits, beginning with the earned income tax credit. Chris, did you want to say anything before we get started?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's just that you do have a couple of handouts. You have one, that a summary handout. It's titled Income Tax Credits, which is just very cursory information on the four or five credits you're going to hear. And this group of credits provides part of the variety of the credits that you'll be dealing with in the session in terms of administering the credits. Some credits have the situation is where a state agency directly administers the credits, where there's a certification process. And we have some state agencies talking today. Other credits, like the EIC, there isn't necessarily an agency that administers the tax credit. So of the five credits that you'll be hearing today, there's some variety along those lines.
Okay. Thank you. That's a good point of distinction. And so we will start today with the earned income tax credit. Representative Rosenbaum.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, and illustrious members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees. I am Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, and very glad to be here with a group of people who will speak to you shortly about our state earned income tax credit. And as you know, because most of you have been on this committee for a while, our earned income tax credit will be sunsetting in next session's 2013. So though we've come before you many, many times and talked about how vital this credit is to 250,000 hardworking Oregonians, now is definitely the time to have this discussion and have it very seriously. With me today, just so you'll know who you'll be hearing from and in what order, are Patty Whitney Wise, the Executive Director of the Oregon Hunger Task Force, Ben Heldren, who is from the Naya Family Center and is a person who helps people apply for the credit, Jason Gettle from Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I believe you've all received a copy of the report that they just released that's chock full of information about the credit. And then finally, batting wrap-up will be John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. So I'll just briefly introduce the topic. I think our group that's been working for a long time on making sure this credit stays in place in Oregon and believes it could be strengthened, really believe that this needs to be an absolute top priority when we come into session in 2013. And that is because of all the kinds of expenditures and credits that we talk about. The earned income tax credit in Oregon, I think, has helped so many people do exactly the things that we talk a lot about. That is that this is, by and large, overwhelmingly people who work at very low income with children. And this is a credit that allows these folks to be able to stay employed, make work pay, feed their kids, pay their rent, and keep a roof over their heads, and maybe have a little money left over to repair the car so that they can get to work. This credit benefits Oregonians in every one of your districts, and lots of them, and you'll hear numbers shortly, but from Portland to Prineville, no matter where you are, if you're struggling to get by and you have a job, and you have children in most cases, this is something that really is of help to you. In fact, I think it can be a lifeline for those families. Just briefly, we've had this credit in Oregon since 1997. You'll hear a little more about technically how it works, but it's interesting to go back because I'm not sure if any of you, maybe Senator Burdick was here in 1997. It was actually created when Senator Brady Adams was the president of the Senate, and he was a banker. And I think he understood very well that this credit not only would help people who are working and need to have some help getting by, but that it would help the economy. This money is spent overwhelmingly in all those local communities because these are folks who don't have money to sock away. So it does provide a real economic stimulus to our small businesses that have also had a hard time surviving the last few years. So I think it makes good sense in terms of economic policy, in terms of what we want to do for the Oregonians that we want to have be able to stay employed and feed their families. And basically, I will turn it over to the others, but I just want to mention, because day after tomorrow we'll all be sitting down with our families and eating a nice turkey dinner, or in Representative Bailey's district, perhaps a tofurkey for some people. But I think as we're doing that and as we're thinking about the many blessings that we all have, and one of those is certainly the fact that our economy is slowly coming back, there still are lots and lots of people, sometimes right next door, you don't always see it, who are not as lucky and are having a hard time. And this is something that you can do with both your head and your heart and feel really good about, because it's sensible policy. It helps 250,000 Oregonians, and I would just commend to you the renewal of this credit and strengthening it if possible. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity, and I'll turn it over to Patty Whitney Wise.
Thank you. Thank you. Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And you have all heard me testify on the earned income tax credit over the years, so I'm going to try to inject a few new pieces of information just to change it up a bit. Obviously, what Senator Rosenbaum has presented is very key and goes to the heart of the matter. We should allow our working low-income families to have enough income to provide for their basic needs. And the earned income tax credit really helps to do that. Both the federal and state combined are really good public policy. They help put food on the table, pay the rent, help stabilize families in their communities so that their children are able to do well in school. They're not worried about where they're going to live next, where their next meal is coming from. In fact, in Oregon, the average number of households receiving the EIC in each Senate district is around 8,800, a little bit more. That was in 2010. And those tax credits returned a little bit over $17 million into each district. That's a lot of money. And in fact, in many rural counties, they have a higher percentage of their filers filing for earned income tax credit than in the urban areas. So more low-wage workers in those rural communities, more of those federal and state dollars going back into those communities with those families who are going to spend them in the local community for their basic needs. So the EIC becomes an economic driver in many communities, especially in the rural areas as well. So it's a win-win. It's a win for the families. It's a win for the local economy. It's a win for the schools who have children who are coming in better shape to learn in their schools. And I just want to offer three perspectives in closing. The National Community Tax Coalition reports that the earned income tax credit ensures that business customers' bases have more to spend, thus helping arrest and beginning to reverse the downward spiral of layoffs and cutbacks. So at a time when we're inching forward, this earned income tax credit can help us move forward faster. Another from California economist David Newmark: using the earned income tax credit to create jobs confers four advantages. First, the EITC does not create stigma effects. Second, it's easy and inexpensive to administer. Third, worker subsidies such as the EITC do more to help low-income families. And fourth, there's clear evidence that the EITC increases employment. Oregon is one of the only states where we actually tax wages below the poverty level. And one of the things you've heard us say before, beyond just extending it, is the importance of trying to expand our state EITC to 18% of the federal credit. That would mean that most low-wage workers with children would not start paying state taxes until above the poverty line, which I think is very key if we really want those families to be stable. So you'll be hearing more from us during the session as well about where the possibilities might be to bump it up a bit so that these families have the money they need to provide their basic needs. And then finally, in research last year from the American Sociological Review, they published a study, it was a long-term study, that linked families accessing the earned income tax credits with improved infant health and well-being, leading to reduced negative outcomes later in life. So a long-term study that really shows the benefit of that little bit of extra income for those low-wage families and how it can affect their children over a lifetime. So we encourage you to strongly support extending and expanding the EITC. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to pull you out kind of as as an example of what we'll be looking for when we look at all these tax credits, and that is the point you made, because, you know, all the tax credits are very much appreciated by the people who receive them. But what we're in charge of in this committee and the Joint Committee on Tax Credits is making sure that the Oregonians who are paying for these tax credits, because it's just as much an expenditure as if we were to make a budget item, to make sure that the Oregon taxpayers are getting some benefit out of it. So I want to single out the comments that you made about the impact on the economy, the impact on communities, and the impact on future productive citizens as an example of what kind of support we're going to be looking for with all the tax credits, not just the benefit to the beneficiaries who receive them, because there are many worthy people out there. So thank you for letting me use an example.
Sure.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Ben Helgren. I'm with the Native American Youth and Family Center. My title is financial skills coach. I directly work with people managing their money, filing their taxes, budgeting for their future, and planning their spending. I see the tax credit as really important. It's a time of the year when people have money to spend. The money gets spent back in the community in order for them to reach their goals that I help them set. So the funds are really integral to families being able to survive, being able to transportation, being able to get to work so they can continue to work, and a motivation to continue to work and have a positive outlook on the state government and how the state can help them.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jason Gettle. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And in addition to my testimony here, we've also submitted a copy of our newest report. In addition to that, I just wanted to make a few quick points to highlight some information in there, and as well as to give you a little bit of additional information. First, the earned income tax credit, as others have mentioned, is good policy. It benefits a lot of people. It's a well-targeted tax credit that allows low and moderate income working families to keep more of what they earn. And it helps a lot of families, as others have mentioned. It's about, in 2010, about a quarter million working families in Oregon benefited from the credit. And as Patty mentioned, these are families that live all across the state. And the credit is designed in such a way that in order to benefit from it, the families must work. Only income that is derived from work is eligible to be counted towards the calculations of one's the dollar amount of one's credit. And as people earn more, the size of that credit increases as well, up until a point, and then as people become more self-sufficient, it begins to phase out. The federal earned income tax credit is actually the best anti-poverty program that we have available for working families, especially working families with children. In 2010, it lifted about 6 million people across the country out of poverty, and that included about 3 million children. The Oregon credit builds on this success, and it's a relatively small investment that can be the state can make that benefits a lot of people all across the state. The second point I wanted to make is that Oregon needs an earned income tax credit. We all know that poverty is a problem here in Oregon, as it has been across the country, and it's a growing problem, especially since the recession. Heading into the recession in 2007, about 12.9% of Oregonians were in poverty, but last year in 2011, that had increased to 17.5%. That means that last year, about 660,000 Oregonians were living in poverty, and that includes about one out of every four Oregon children. And sadly, many Oregonians are living in poverty despite the fact that they work. In 2011, over two-thirds of families in poverty with children had at least one parent that worked. And even a full-time job is not necessarily a guarantee of escaping poverty. That same year, about 22% of all families in poverty with children had at least one parent that worked full-time year-round. And it's by the design of the earned income tax credit, these are the families that benefit the most from the credit. Low and moderate income working families with children living at or near the poverty line. And that brings me to my third point. Now is the time that we need the earned income tax credit. Not only do we not want to reduce the incomes of these low and moderate income working families, but we can do more as we enter the economic recovery that we talked about earlier with the economic forecast. Not renewing the credit would take about $300 away from a two-parent family raising two children living on poverty-level wages. And in addition to not taking money away from these families, we can also, now is the time that the EITC can do some of its best work. As the economic forecast mentioned earlier, we're in for a slow recovery. But it is a recovery, and people are re-entering the labor force. And people hopefully are starting to work more hours, and hopefully will earn more as a result. There are increased costs that come with re-entering the labor force and with working more hours. The earned income tax credit is something that helps cover some of those costs. Families face increased tax obligations, increased transportation costs, as well as increased child care expenses. The EITC can help mitigate some of these costs and allow people to stay in the labor force that may otherwise have been unable to do so. So just to reiterate, I believe that the earned income tax credit is a good policy that benefits about a quarter million people all across the state. Oregon needs an earned income tax credit, and now is the time that Oregon needs the EITC. Thank you for your time. I'll turn it over to John Mullen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committees, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm also co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. I just want to be very brief in a couple of comments and thank Senator Rosenbaum for her leadership and Patty Whitney Wise for convening our Working Families Coalition that has been working on this for a number of years, and the excellent work that has been done by the Oregon Center for Public Policy. The Working Families Coalition, by the way, is about 100 different organizations, very widespread support for the earned income tax credit around the state. And as we all realize, the matter that's before you in the 2013 session is the extension of the sunset, which we are very much committed to. But as also, as Patty Whitney Wise pointed out, our coalition is very interested to work on the expansion of the earned income tax credit for the reasons that she mentioned, because of the way the tax structure exists here in Oregon, to be able to give working families the opportunity to get ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions of this panel, including Ms. Whitney? Okay. Thank you. Whitney Wise, excuse me. Okay. These were all the people who were signed up. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on this? Okay. We'll move on to our next tax credit, the political contributions tax credit. Chris?
Well, I guess the summary information, this is a credit that taxpayers get. It's either $50 for single or up to $100 for contributions made to political candidates or parties, and it's non-refundable, but it's a full credit for up to either $50 or $100.
Okay, and we have the Most Honorable Kate Brown joining us today. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me here today. For the record, Kate Brown, currently serving as Oregon Secretary of State. Mr. Co-Chair is Madam Co-Chair on the phone. Co-Chair Berger?
She's actually attending a meeting of the Capital Foundation, and she will be in and out.
That is a very important cause, and I thank her for her efforts. And Chair Burdick, delighted to be here with you this morning to talk about the political tax credit. Oregon is one of nine states that has a political tax credit. It was first established in Oregon back in 1969. I think that's 43 years ago. I think everyone in this room knows that when you contribute to ballot measure campaigns, candidates, political parties, parties or PACs, you can receive up to a $50 credit if you're a single filer, and for joint filers can receive up to a $100 credit. Data provided by the Oregon Department of Revenue going back to 1990 indicates that more Oregonians are using the political tax credit now than in the past. In 1997, 3.4% of filers claimed the political tax credit. We now, however, did hit an all-time high in 2008 with 7.8% of taxpayer claiming the credit. Obviously, the use of the political tax credit tends to be cyclical. For example, in presidential elections, more people tend to be engaged. We see more people using the credit at that point in time. Or when there are very high-profile ballot measure campaigns, people are more likely to claim the tax credit then as well. As everyone knows, this year was a presidential election, and we estimate the impact of the tax credit this biennium to be roughly $14.9 million. I believe you have a table in front of you showing that a majority of the filers who claim the tax credit earn over $77,000 a year. I believe that includes joint filers. In talking with the department this morning, they provided an additional table showing the impact on higher income levels. It's 1.456. I've also asked the department for additional information in terms of numbers of folks living in households. It will take a few weeks to provide that information, but I thought that might be helpful as well. And I wanted to thank the department for providing us with the information. While I don't administer the tax credit, as your Secretary of State, I'm responsible for enforcing Oregon's campaign finance laws, and I have a couple of thoughts I wanted to share about the tax credit. It's my understanding that the original purpose of the tax credit is to increase participation in the political process. And as your Secretary of State, I certainly share that goal of reducing barriers for Oregonians to participate in the political process. I would argue that the Oregon political tax credit enables Oregonians at diverse levels of income to participate. And while we don't have the data to determine whether the tax credit increases the number of people participating or whether it simply allows people to contribute in somewhat larger denominations, what I would say is that it allows people to organize and contribute small amounts of money, enabling them to have an impact on the process and enabling individuals to have a voice in the process. And in this era of citizens, post-Citizens United, I think that's an increasingly important feature of the political tax credit. Lastly, I just want to share, I will be leading a conversation about contribution limits during the 2013 legislative session. I'm hoping that I will get some of you to participate in that conversation with me, but any discussion about continuing the tax credit should be made in concert with those discussions as well. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions that you might have. Probably most of your technical questions would go to the Department of Revenue since they are collecting all the data that I've provided to you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Do you have any thoughts on, aside from encouraging people to get involved in the process, and of course your chart shows that, or the chart that you presented shows that most of the benefit goes to the higher income people from the tax credit. Do you have any other thoughts on what benefit this is overall to Oregon taxpayers?
Madam Chair, what I would say is that I think it's extremely important that we reduce barriers for people to participate in the political process and that Oregonians have benefit as a whole by enabling people of all income levels to have a voice in campaigns. And I think that's a really important benefit. I think it's also a really important tool for organizations to use the political tax credit. I think that benefits Oregonians as a whole as well.
Thank you. Senator Hess.
Thank you. I think you and I both agree that this is a benefit, and I think you and I both agree that schools in this state are underfunded. So I think you know where I'm going with this. And while I think, you know, it's a benefit, I think that there's a greater good that can be done with that $15 million in terms of education than in this tax credit that looks like it tends to hit higher-end taxpayers more that does the lower end. So I'm just wondering if you could, what you say to that line of argument?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, I know that you have some difficult decisions ahead of you, and obviously funding schools is a priority for me as well. I think what I would say in terms of the political tax credit, and the reason why I asked the department for more detailed information to really get a sense of who was using the tax credit, is is there a way that we could means test this in a way that might be useful, still enable Oregonians at diverse income levels to participate? So that's why I asked the department for more detailed information, and we can certainly, if the committee has more questions, get some more information to you. But I think one of the pieces that I would put on the table is does it make sense to means test this particular tax credit? But I think it's extremely important that we enable Oregonians, particularly at middle and lower income levels, to be able to participate in the political process. And I have to say the political tax credit enables them to do this. So I think it's extremely important.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Secretary Brown was the only one to sign up. Do we have other people who want to testify on this?
Madam Chair, I assume we will be having further conversations about this during the next session, and I look forward to having other colleagues that support this provide you with additional information.
Yes, you
thank
can,
you.
You can count on that. Thank you very much. Okay, our next tax credit is the Cultural Trust. Chris?
The Cultural Trust is a credit where somebody can earn the credit. They make a contribution to a cultural organization. And then they, if they make a contribution to the Oregon Cultural Trust Fund for an amount up to that amount, up to the same amount, then they can get a credit for that, up to $500 for single filers, $1,000 for joint lift filers, or $2,500 for corporations.
Okay.
So they have, it's kind of a dual contribution.
All right. We have Chris Darcy with us to say more about this credit. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Darcy. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. Oregon's cultural tax credit generates revenue for the Oregon Cultural Trust, which, along with the Oregon Arts Commission, is the state-level funding and cultural policy development entity in Oregon. Both are included in the education area of Oregon's 10-year roadmap for education, where outcomes provide that Oregonians are prepared for lifelong learning, rewarding work, and engaged citizenship. Over 500,000 youth here benefit directly from arts and cultural programs in their schools and in their communities. And as they grow older as active citizens, those students who have experienced arts and culture will continue to engage on many levels during their life through hundreds of concerts, exhibitions, readings, performances, lectures, and demonstrations. Culture permeates racial, geographic, and generational walls. The credit was established as an incentive for Oregonians to generate more resources for the arts, heritage, and humanities. Since 2002, Oregonians have used the tax credit to contribute over $25 million for Oregon culture. In that same period, over $10 million has been awarded in grants. The balance remains in a permanent fund. The Cultural Trust is now regarded as Oregon's national model for integrated cultural funding. It's unique in its engagement of Oregonians around culture. Cultural coalitions in each of Oregon's 36 counties and within the 9 federally recognized tribes not only bring community volunteers together for cultural planning, but facilitate community dialogue about what cultural investments should be made. The Cultural Trust supports a network of 1,300 cultural nonprofits across the state. That's 10% of Oregon's nonprofit sector that provide programming in every corner of the state. This credit has a solid multiplier effect. As was suggested, a donor must contribute to any one of Oregon's cultural nonprofits and then make a gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust. Gifts are entirely voluntary. Donors to the Cultural Trust from the high population counties are generating the resources to support culture in our most remote counties. And in counties with small populations, Wheeler County, Gillum County, the cultural investment that has increased due to the involvement of the Oregon Cultural Trust has been remarkable. The trust benefits all of Oregon. Beneficiaries include children, families, and organizations. About 6 million people experience culture in Oregon each year. We are home to the largest regional theater company in the country. Portland's Cultural District is home to many of our largest cultural institutions. And in Eugene, the resident companies of the Holt Center bring people downtown. Nonprofits, small historical societies, and everything in between use the cultural tax credit as an incentive to increase their own fundraising and then to raise this shared fund across the state. We support everything from libraries. In Josephine County, our community library has acquired Spanish language children's books, bilingual books for non-English language learners. And the funds generated using the cultural tax credit actually export culture from our large population centers to small communities around the state. The trust connects culture with education, the economy, and civic engagement. It's really supporting the foundations of our community. But beyond those intrinsic values, the arts and cultural sector contributes to job retention, income, and tax revenue to Oregon's economy. The cultural sector in Oregon contributes both indirectly and directly to Oregon's economy. In 2011, the Trust's 1,300 cultural nonprofits directly generated an estimated $580 million in sales and employed over 8,000 people who received over $270 million in income. Those direct contributions ripple through the economy. Using multipliers, the total economic impacts associated with eligible cultural nonprofits amount to over $1.2 billion in sales. And $1 million in sales by these eligible cultural nonprofits generates another $1.1 million in sales for other Oregon businesses. More broadly, over 19,000 Oregonians work in arts and culture occupations, nearly as many as work in the legal sector. The cultural sector contributes to Oregon's ability to grow over the long run. Many economists argue that arts and culture help boost a region's capacity by making individuals smarter, healthier, and more productive, by contributing to a desirable quality of life, and by helping to create a culture of creativity that fuels our innovation economy. The Cultural Trust has become the trusted, transparent public entity that ensures that Oregonians have wide access to culture and the arts, and that Oregon cultural groups statewide contribute to their local economies, revitalize our downtowns, and employ Oregonians. The cultural tax credit is achieving its public purpose by building participation in culture and generating both public and private investment in the arts. The original timeline for the building of a permanent fund for culture in Oregon sufficient to meet the needs of Oregon's cultural organizations was 10 years. That was based on not only the use of the cultural tax credit, but the sale of a cultural license plate and the transfer of surplus state assets, namely lands, to benefit the cultural trust. Without the expected transfer of those state lands, it will take longer to build the permanent fund for culture that we need to support our arts, heritage, and humanities. What is expected to happen if this credit were to fully sunset? The ability of the cultural trust to generate the kind of revenue to support a cultural sector of the size of ours would simply not be possible. In FY12, only 25% to 30% of the funding requests that came before the Oregon Cultural Trust could be funded simply because of the dollars available. If the credit were scaled back, even fewer of those projects would be able to be supported. The Oregon Cultural Trust has truly become a national model for its public-private partnership, for its creation of a grassroots network of local cultural coalitions, for its ability to bring together multiple state agencies that have a stake in culture, and for its recognition of tribal government as equal to our counties. Other states have trust-like programs. Most are limited to the arts. None have the really expansive volunteer rallying point around culture that we've been able to create in Oregon, and we hope that will continue in the future. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to testify on the cultural trust credit? Going once, going twice. Okay. Next one, farm worker housing and lenders credits.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these are two credits that have the same policy goal of creating or increasing farm worker housing. And you're going to hear from housing department, and they primarily administer the construction credit, which is a credit. It's a 50% credit on it's a credit worth 50% of eligible costs that go into the construction of housing, farm worker housing. The lender credit is a credit against interest earned by institutions for low interest rate loans to encourage farm worker housing. So I think most of the testimony you're going to hear now is primarily on the construction credit, which is one that they administer. There isn't a peer administering agency for the lender's credit.
Okay. Welcome.
Mm-hmm. Chair Burdick and Co-Chair Barnhart, my name is Karen Tolfstad. I am administrator at Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I oversee the division responsible for policy, strategy, and community engagement. I understand that this committee and others have, like EITC, spent a lot of time looking at this credit in the past. So I will provide a high-level overview and not get into all of the details. I understand that in 2011, this passed the House Ag Committee and the Joint Tax Credit Subcommittee, and in 2012 it passed the House Energy Committee and got to the Finance Revenue Committees, where it had full hearings from both. And at that time, I know we also provided information in writing related to many questions that have been asked in the past. So I'm going to just give a brief overview of the program and how and where it has been used, also trends in the need for housing for agricultural workers and in the use of the program, and then recap some of the work that has been done since the 2011 session to respond to questions and issues that have been raised by committee members. So just as real high-level background, the tax credit program took effect in 1990 but was instigated because of the legislative declaration in 89, where it specifically said the policy of the state is to ensure adequate agricultural labor accommodations commensurate with need that meet decent health, safety, and welfare standards. So the program, tax credit program, construction program, was introduced in 1990 in order to help meet those. It was originally administered by OROSHA, a division of Department of Consumer and Business Services, and it transferred to our agency in 2002. So the data that I'm going to share with you is since 2002. At that time, 2002, also a very extensive study was conducted, very extensive, and so extensive and quite honestly expensive that it has not been repeated. And that data, though, has been really used and cited by all government agencies. It is actually being repeated right now. It's two-thirds of the way done. Oregon Health Authority is repeating that survey, and it'll be done by the end of first quarter of 2013. That study was found to really have the best counts, if you will, of a difficult-to-count population. It showed over 103 migrant and seasonal farm workers, 175 if you include their families. And the difference between migrant and seasonal definitions is just that migrant do not have over 50% of their income coming from farm work. So seasonal have 51% or more of their income coming from farm work. Migrants tend to just stay a shorter period of time. Another recent study that we do have is by the Oregon Employment Department, which is estimating 98,000. So again, we're all kind of waiting for that new study, however. Other commonly known or referenced number is that workers contribute to Oregon ag production at about $4.4 billion. That was a 2010 figure, so a big part of our economy. So when we're looking at those, the impact on the economy and the count of farm workers, and go back to the task, which was providing housing commensurate with need, our department does a study where we count all affordable housing that is dedicated to different populations. So we go and look at all affordable housing that's been provided for, like, special needs populations of all kinds. Migrant or farm workers or agriculture workers is one. When we do that comparison and evaluate, not on farm housing, but in general farm worker housing that's been produced, and then calculate that against the count of farm workers, our data shows 2% of farm workers have housing dedicated to their needs. If you look at the broader picture and actually count registered farm camps and all of that, it's about 9%. So about 9% of agricultural workers have affordable housing dedicated to their needs. So to show what's been happening to try to address those needs, this chart shows the total units that have been created in the farm worker housing tax credits, and that with farm worker housing tax credits, and that shows about 1,264 units. Some of those units would be a one-unit project on a farm, and some of those are a 24 complex in town. All of them have access to the same credits. And this shows a distribution by county. There's been projects built or rehabilitated in 17 of our counties, clearly Hood River and Wasco taking the dominant portion. This shows just trend year by year, and basically shows that we reach our cap nearly every year. So in looking at extending the farm worker housing tax credit, certainly advocates would clearly tell you that one of the reasons is because the job is not done. The state policy objective was providing housing commensurate with need, and there is still tremendous need. The advocates in the community have created a coalition of over 100 strong, including growers, ag industry, housing developers, and others who are promoting the extension of the credit, and I think you have information from them as well. Another reason, however, to look at extending the credit is because there is actually additional need, or a new need, in that the standards for on-farm housing are increasing starting in 2018. The federal standards have changed, and OROSHA is adopting those, and we know that that is going to create additional need. It's going to put higher standards are a good thing for health and safety of the individuals. However, they also put a burden on the growers and the ag industry at a kind of a sensitive time in our industry, in our economic life. So looking at some of the trends, one of the things that we are hearing from growers is that the dynamics of the workers that they're getting are different, and they are seeing less of the very experienced workers returning, and they're finding that they are being attracted by other states and by other industries, and that they see more and better housing on farm as a competitive advantage, and they are looking for reasons to have a competitive advantage to offer to get those skilled workers back. Another major trend that you're seeing since this initiated in 1990 is the development of housing that is not on farm, and the tax credit allows for both, and there's a lot more housing that is being done in communities, and one of the benefits is that it attracts more of the longer-term workers. A lot of the ag community is attempting to keep those seasonal workers busy with other processing agriculture opportunities. The definition of farm worker was recently changed to include processing and storage workers as far as agricultural workers. So these in-community projects tend to meet those needs very well. They're often located next to health clinics. They have bilingual staff and have other support mechanisms for the community and for the family, and are seen as really stabilizing that industry and the farm worker base. So since the 2011 session, there were a lot of questions by different committee members, and the agencies that all touched the program took it seriously, and one of the things that was asked for was for those agencies to work better on the coordination, tracking, monitoring of the programs. And I believe in the 2012 short session, you received a copy of the memo of understanding that was created, and I have provided that for you again today. It outlines very clearly the responsibilities of the three agencies that work together on the program, Oregon Housing and Community Services, Department of Revenue, and OSHA. And it really clarifies responsibilities and strengthens the coordination of those programs. And we are implementing, proceduralizing and implementing those right now to respond to those.
Questions?
Thank you. I'd be happy to.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. You mentioned the beneficiaries of this as developers, mm-hmm. housing industry, growers, and others. Would you say they benefit more than actual farm workers?
No, I think the industry, the economic development industry, or the economic development in our state definitely benefits. But the primary reason for this tax credit is still to provide decent, safe, sanitary housing. And we do know that, again, with the increased standards, there's going to be even more need for that. That is the true beneficiary.
Well, if I could, Madam Chair, if the standards are there, doesn't this just subsidize those groups that you identified, industry and developers?
I think what it would do is there's some of those growers that probably would choose not to upgrade the housing to the new standards, and that we would lose, the industry would lose some of our best seasoned workers.
If they didn't upgrade to the standards, then how does that play out?
If they didn't upgrade the standards, I think that they would, again, lose some of those workers, so it would affect them negatively, affect growers, and affect the industry. Of course, those who elect to fund it on their own without the 50% tax credit, take that money from somewhere.
I think what Senator Hess is trying to get at is when you don't comply with standards, things happen.
Yes.
And so they would have penalties, mm-hmm. or?
No, I don't. That would be a question for OSHA, exactly what happens, whether they have to close it down or get a penalty for not complying.
Representative Barnhart.
I think another way, if I could, Madam Chair, of getting at this would be to ask for data on the number of units or type of units that are constructed beyond the limit of the tax credits. You noted in one of your slides that the tax credit tends to be fully subscribed.
Mm-hmm.
It would be useful to have data on other units that do not benefit from the tax credit that were built in that same time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll look for that. Thank you.
I think that gets it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes our agenda on the tax credit. You did mention five tax credits. We've got the other one is our rural medical tax credit, and we'll be talking about that later.
Last time, if you recall, in August, the committee discussed three credits. There was the manufacturing Betsy, the
right.
film and video, and the rural
right.
medical. The fifth one here that is the farm worker housing lenders credit.
Oh, okay.
And that's the one that's one of these credits. It doesn't have a state agency administering it.
Okay.
But that's a credit for loans made to entities constructing these, and it's a credit. It's a 50% credit against the interest. Earned on the interest income earned on such loans.
So a single housing development could qualify for both of these on top of each other?
I'm not sure right now. That's one of the things I'm trying to figure out, how these two credits interact.
Okay.
I mean, the developer would be building it, and then ostensibly they took a loan. If they took a loan out from a bank, then the bank would benefit from that loan, and then developer would benefit from this credit. So they could be used in conjunction, but not necessarily by the same
beneficiaries.
Entity. That would be my guess right now.
Well, if I may, so one of the things you're looking into is the way in which these two credits interact with each other on similar same projects.
Okay, thank you.
And in the course of that, it would be useful to find out how often a developer uses one but not the other. and, you know, kind of break it down. How many of them use none of them? How many of them use just one, and how many of them use the other?
And judging from initial tax return information, a lot more entities will be using the construction credit. The lender's credit isn't used extensively. It's a very small number. And so that's another reason to...
Senator Telfer.
So it would appear to me that the incentive behind this credit, or these two credits, and that is the purpose of a credit, is to be an incentive for some behavior. One is to incentivize lending, so to encourage banks to loan money, and the other one is for the farm owner to, in fact, construct the housing, which they benefit in numerous ways along with a credit, a financial incentive.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you. We're ahead of schedule.
That's a good thing.
Fairly significantly. Are we prepared to go into this next item? Dr. Warner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're always prepared.
Okay. The
next item on your agenda is on the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program, the status and update. And we have a couple of elements to that. The first is Christine and John Phillips will come up and talk about the status of the fund right now. The Department of Revenue, of course, just sent out property tax payments to the counties last week, I guess, or even, well, yeah, 15, so this week. So they'll give you a sense of the status of the program. Remember, these are the last property tax payments that the department will send off before the end of the biennium. So this will be the last data you get on that prior to the 13th session. The other piece is that, as you recall, there was you gave a directive to the Department of Revenue to conduct a survey of participants of the program. And the department has been working with Oregon State and Bruce Weber and Brent Steele are here, and they will talk about that survey with you that is ready to go in the field shortly. So they'll follow John and Christine.
Okay, great. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. Just here today to talk a little bit about the new updates in the Senior Deferral Program. The payments went out in November 15th, and they were totaling $13.7 million. So this was slightly less than forecast in payment obligations. Overall, as you remember, the program was extended for existing participants with reverse mortgages. The November 2011 balance ended up being $1.6 million after the payment obligations were complete. What we saw that really made the outcome a little bit rosier than the forecast was that there was a lot of repayment activity immediately after House Bill 2543. So people found out they were inactivated for whatever reason, and they responded by paying off the amount they owed. Repayments in recent years have been a little bit higher than they used to be. Typically, you'd see about $1.1 to $1.3 million a month in repayments. And this year, the average repayment per month was $1.6 million. The two biggest months were November and December, and they both had about $2.4 million in repayments per month. So we expect that to taper off into the future as those people phase out and pay off their debt and leave the program. So in November 2012, I like to think of this as setting aside the $19 million that was loaned from the Common School Fund, because that money is going to be paid back. So I set it aside and just talk about the account absent that money. November 2012 started with a balance of $15.1 million. So with a payment obligation of $13.7 million and an estimated $1.6 million in repayments that come in November. We don't have that information quite yet about what the repayments were, but all said and done, there's $3 million in the account, and this has exceeded our forecasts. Had done a near-term forecast thinking there would be $1.6 million in the account after these payments, but it has exceeded that a little bit at $3.0 million. So in the future, the account has a little bit quicker growth in the near term as the repayments come in a little bit more. And then, you know, it's estimated to grow between $2 and $3 million per year thereafter into the long term. So the reverse mortgage participants have been reinstated, and they the additional payments that would result from that group being included is expected to sort of taper off over time as they naturally just phase out of the program. It's assumed that the average participant stays in for 7 years, so we lose 1/7 of that group every year just through naturally leaving the home. So that about wraps up where the program is into the future, and with that I can turn it over to John.
Okay, before you do, there's as I understand you, there's no issue about our ability to repay that loan.
No.
The loan is secure.
Yes, it's due in, I think, June of 2013, and so there will be, even on top of that, $3 million additional repayments coming in, and so it'll have enough.
Can I ask Christine a question?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine, you said that there was higher payoff of loans than anticipated, you know, thus the increased ending fund balance. Do you have an idea as to those payoffs? Were they refinances, or were people able to come up with the money to pay it off and get out of the program, or was there a title change?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we don't actually have the specifics of people's circumstances as they repay. There's really I don't know if there's a way to get to that without specifically surveying them, but I would assume that they had probably come up with the money in some cases, you know, and been able to separate from the program, even though they didn't have to until they actually left their home. Some chose to probably depart early. We see that at a faster rate than would be just normally, you know, with them leaving their home.
Follow-up. So people in the program, they stay in the program until they tell you they no longer qualify for the program because they have either financed or transferred title one way or another. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Members of the Joint Committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you. I think Christine's done an excellent job of covering the main points. All I was going to punctuate on top of that was the point you made, Madam Chair, and that is that there is sufficient revenue to pay the $19 million plus interest in June, as long as no other changes are made. The second point I'd make is that we did pony up another $3 million last May to pay for the 2011 payment. We went back in time and paid the taxes of people that you added to the program last February. So we subtracted from our revolving account $3 million last May, paid those taxes for last May, and then we paid additional money this week, for those roughly 1,520 people that were added back into the program. As you will recall, House Bill 4039 from last February created that payment, for those two payments, and it also ends. So this week, I mean, with this payment, those people are effectively looking for being on their own next November. They will be out of the program according to the law. So unless you choose to make a change in that condition, they are done.
Okay. And of course, the extension applied only to people who were excluded by sole reason of a reverse mortgage.
Exactly, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. I missed the number. Yeah, I got the number from May of $3 million. What was the number this month?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I don't have that number broken out.
But you'll get that for us later.
I will try to get that number for you later. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Hess.
Thanks. Just a comment, really, at the risk of sounding like a cranky old uncle here, but I just think it's poor public policy to borrow from the common school fund. And I know we did it here. I know it's going to get paid back. But it feels a lot like the federal government, you know, borrowing from Social Security. And this is a fund that was set up by Oregon pioneers. And it just feels like poor public policy. We're supposed to work on balanced budgets, whatever the situation. So I hope this was a one-time aberration. And can resist that temptation going forward.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up because I had the same reservations. This was a certified emergency that we did, and we did everything we could to make sure that the payment was secure. And I'm glad to hear that the strategy worked, and I hope I never have to see this happen again in terms of borrowing from the school fund.
Right. Just, if I may, I completely agree with both of those comments. However, the Common School Fund is invested in order to earn money. This was another investment for the Common School Fund. It was important that we do everything we could to make certain that that investment was secure. And I think that in fact we did do that. While I agree that this is not the kind of practice that we ought to engage in a normal course of things, that money is invested at some risk somewhere all the time.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this? Thank you.
I'm going to ask Christine to come up and then Bruce Weber and Brent Steele.
For this?
Yes, they're going to do the survey.
Oh, right. Bruce, okay.
If I might lead off.
Please.
Oh, Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. You had asked that we do this survey in conjunction with the Legislative Revenue Office. We did contract with the Oregon State University, Bruce Weber and Brent Steele here, which I very much appreciate coming up today. And it's been a good process so far, I believe, and very clear. We took clues from you, both committees, and from input from the Vulnerable Housing Group from David Raphael, and also from the AARP through Rick Bennett. So we feel like we did everything we could to comport the survey with your needs, and they're here to talk about it today.
Okay, and if you would introduce yourself before you speak.
Okay, I'm Brent Steele. I'm a professor of public policy at Oregon State.
Okay.
And I'm Bruce Weber, director of the Rural Studies Program at Oregon State University.
Okay. Who wants to start?
Madam Chair, we could talk about just where we are in the process right now. As John said, we worked on the design of the survey rather quickly, and we got it out, a mail survey to all participants, 7,300 plus. It went out November 8th, 9th, and 10th. The 10th is a Saturday, but so some of those went out on Monday. We have a group of about 10 graduate students working on this right now in the public policy program. We did a mail survey in a form. We do lots of mail surveys at Oregon State, so we put it in a format that seniors could easily fill out. Surveys hit. We had a business reply envelope. We had the cover letter. I think you have a copy of. And the survey's anonymous when we tell the respondents that in the cover letter, so that we get good information back. On Monday of this week, we got about 30 surveys back. Yesterday, we got 353, so they're rolling in right now, and we're keep punching them as they come in. And we are hoping, and we're going to send out a reminder anonymous postcard next week on Tuesday thanking them for returning the survey if they have, or giving them a chance to fill it out and respond, or if they need a new survey, we could send it out. And we plan to have a preliminary report, I think, as on, if I'm remembering, December 15th, okay, on what we have so far, and we're going to continue, keep punching up to probably about Christmas time. I think we'll be finished by about that time, and then we'll have a final report ready for your next meeting in January on this, where we've done some analysis on the data. One of the things that was, it's been kind of interesting, we had a record number of telephone calls with people that are interested in the survey, so I responded to over 80 on Thursday and Friday last week with people that are, it's pretty dire straits, to be honest with you, and just concerned about the program, but we're offering some insights. And then we've, I think I did another 20 yesterday, and Bruce has been responding to quite a few, so there's a lot of interest in the survey, which is a good thing. So so we're hoping for a very good response rate.
Okay. Did you have anything to add, Mr. Weber?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing the results of this as well. Christine, did you have anything you wanted to add to this part of it?
No, Manager, I don't know.
Okay. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your work on this. Okay. We're moving right along, committee. Now we will have a briefing on what the voters did to us last month, or this month, earlier this month.
Yes.
Or declined to do to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last item on your agenda is initiatives with revenue policy implications. And when we first developed this agenda, of course, we didn't know what we would be putting on that. And we did end up with a fairly short list, really two initiatives that do have pretty direct revenue implications. We did spend a lot of time from the summer on until the election working on them. Mazin spent a lot of time on the 82 and 83, which was a casino initiative, which involved quite a bit of in-depth analysis. And we did also issue a research report on Measure 84, which was the estate tax elimination proposal. And we spent a lot of time with that because there were potential implications with the income tax. But, of course, as many of our reports on initiatives, that will end up in a file that that may not be looked at again very much. The measures that passed, I put together on a one-page outline for you just to go through those very briefly and try to answer any questions that you have. The first two, of course, were those were two that were legislative referrals, Measure 77 and 78. Measure 77 is the one that defines a catastrophic disaster and sets up a process by which the governor can carry out certain activities in this emergency. The legislature would come in, and it spells out kind of that process. And I know while this is one that doesn't have direct revenue policy implications, I know Chair Barnhart is very interested in this and at some point maybe spend some time discussing what might be the implications in terms of committee behavior and what would be the options for committee. There are some changes definitely within tax law and how tax law is treated. For one thing, the stipulation, constitutional stipulation, that you cannot use an emergency clause for a bill relating to taxation, that would be not apply during this catastrophic disaster period. So there's some interesting things and maybe worth spending some committee time perhaps early in the session to talk about what the committee might do in that kind of a situation. The other one involved separation powers and making some language changes that had been in the Constitution for a long time, and that passed by pretty overwhelming numbers. The two that have the most direct revenue policy implications are Measure 79, which prohibits real estate transfer taxes, fees, and other assessments. A key provision in that measure is that It's except for those operative on December 31, 2009. Our interpretation and discussions with council are that this does not preclude changing any of those fees that were on the books in 2009. So in other words, they don't have to be fixed. If they're on the books, they can be changed. For example, you have a series of fees around document recording fees. This would, since they were in place in 2009, this doesn't preclude the legislature changing those fee amounts.
Okay. That's good to hear.
So, and that's it. Also, the one local real estate transfer fee that was grandfathered in when the legislature statutorily prohibited local governments from imposing real estate transfer fee is Washington County's 0.1% of market value of the real estate transaction. In 2010-11, the county raised about $2.3 million. Of course, that's down from what they were raising 6 years ago, but $2.3 million from the tax. This measure would not affect that as well because it was in place on December 31, 2009.
And likewise, would Washington County be free to change the rate of the fee to raise it, for example?
Madam Chair, my answer to that would be yes. I think they would by that same reasoning that I just discussed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you. Paul, I don't know if you're going to go into more detail on this, but I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about the breadth of the prohibition. So, for example, it sounded like you said that there you referred to document recording fees. Would document recording fees in general on real estate transfers be included going forward, not just real estate transfer taxes, but any fees involved in transfer of sale of a home? Is that correct?
Representative Bailey, I believe that's correct if they were not in place on December 31, 2009. But if you have a fee that's in place at that time, that doesn't preclude changing that fee. And then, of course, you get into perhaps some definitional changes of what constitutes a change in a fee versus an actual establishing a new fee. So there'd be in a gray area there. But our interpretation is the document recording fees that go back to the 1990s, you could change those and still be consistent with the Constitution.
Got it.
So, yeah, I was a little puzzled by the 2009 grandfathering date. Why were there some in the ensuing 2 years that will be gotten rid of?
Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of.
If I may, wasn't that the date in the prohibition, in the statutory prohibition for the establishment of new transfer fees?
The 2009 was a year in which the document recording fees were increased, but they had been increased from a previous recording fee.
Right.
So they were not. I would interpret those as still being consistent.
Yeah. If I could, what I was trying to say was, I think that's the date of the original statutory grandfathering of the Washington County fee.
Oh.
My understanding was that was the reason they chose that date. Now, I may be wrong about that, but that was what I thought was the reason for it.
The other thing that we put in under Measure 79 is just to kind of lay out some other the activities of other states around this real estate transfer taxes. We had a little bit of a dated report, but FDA, Federation of Tax Administrators, had a good study on the states some years ago, and we kind of used that to give us a good background on what all the states have done. at the time of that report, which was several years ago, there were 35 states that impose real estate transfer tax. In addition, there are three states that allow local governments to go forward. Oregon wasn't considered in that group because of the prohibition, even though they have the Washington County exception. And seven states allow both. I mean, they have a state real estate transfer fee, and then they allow a local add-on. There are four states that have raised over $100 per capita. This was back in 07, 08, so that may be down a little bit since then. But four states that raised over $100 per capita are Delaware, New Hampshire, Florida, and Washington. And my question to the committee is, what do those four states have in common? Well, that's almost right. There are four states that don't have, each of them don't have either a sales tax or an income tax. One or the other.
One or the
other. Yeah, one or the other.
So Florida and Washington don't have an income tax, and well, of course, New Hampshire doesn't have either one, and Delaware doesn't have a sales tax. So Washington's, we have monitored Washington's real estate transfer tax over the years, and we've included that in our basic tax packet to get an estimate of what potential revenue would be. Their tax is 1.28% of market value of transferred property, and of course, like many states, their revenue is way down from that source. And I just looked at their September forecast, is their latest forecast. They're expecting $808 million in general fund revenue from that 1.28% real estate transfer fee. So it is general fund revenue in Washington's budget.
And they're about double us?
They are almost double us in terms of population size, yes. So in terms of the impact of Measure 79, of course, in order to the one thing that the legislature has considered to some extent in the past, last time I recall a bill on this was 2001, where there was a revenue committee hearing for a local option. Of course, this would preclude that unless there was a change in the Constitution. In terms of a statewide real estate transfer tax, the legislature would no longer have the option, obviously, of putting that in statute. But remember that kind of a quirk to the way the three-fifths majority is interpreted, that a constitutional amendment in the legislature, an HJR, SJR, does not require a three-fifths vote. So that would be a majority vote to establish a real estate transfer tax, and then, of course, would require voter approval at the ballot to change the Constitution. So that would be the process if that was to go forward under this.
But the statutory implementation would still require a three-fifths vote.
Well, but Mr. Chair, the statutory, that would not be an option.
There may not be a statute.
It wouldn't be an option under the Constitution.
Yeah. If we passed a constitutional, no, it's a good question. If we passed a constitutional amendment, we would need a statutory implementation, but that would not require a three-fifths, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions?
And of course the second measure with significant revenue implications is Measure 85, and that what that initiative does is it requires the continued calculation of what I call excess revenue, which is the corporate kicker. And the excess revenue is determined in the same way. So you'd have the state economist projections that you'll get in May based on whatever legislative changes you have serve as the base, and then that will be compared with 13-15 actual revenue that comes in. We won't know whether there's a corporate kicker or not until August of 15. So there's a biennial lag as to when that revenue would be available. Now, of course, under current or under previous law, there would be a credit to corporations, and then over the course of that biennium, we would anticipate less net corporate collections. So now under the new constitutional provision, those dollars would be added to the forecast for that biennium, and then they would be allocated. In the language of the measure says that what under previous law would be the corporate kicker will be retained in the general fund and then used to fund K through 12 education. So we're working a little bit with council on what that retained in the general fund means in terms of what type of
of options you would have in terms of when you would allocate those dollars. So that's something we're working with in a Senate committee bill as to what kind of options you may have to do that. So we'll look for something by your December meeting. We should have something more definitive on what could be done.
Yeah, we're looking at statutory approaches to avoid the problem of dumping a bunch of money in, for example, to hire teachers that you'll just have to fire the next year because there's no more corporate kicker, and also to add to the stability of the education funding. In other words, to really fulfill the voters' intent to make sure it does get to K through 12 and doesn't just get funneled into K through 12 on the front end and funneled out the back end, as so often happens in the budget process.
Good luck.
Thanks. Well, we're trying.
The 2% kicker and the kicker revenue impacts, and I know we've discussed this with you some in the past, it presents a little bit of a challenge in terms of our standard revenue estimating techniques because we base all of our revenue projections on the current law forecast. We use that as the base. Well, of course, the current law forecast, if that's right, there's never a kicker because it's based on a deviation from the kicker. So as an alternative, we go back and use history, and you can, if you look at the 16-year history of the kicker going back to 79, the average amount of revenue, and this would be on a percentage basis, calculated as a percentage of corporate income tax collections, would generate for the next four biennia about $124 million per biennia. So that would be an expected value, and obviously would not be something that would be built into a forecast because it would be a unanticipated or windfall like revenue. We wouldn't know when it would occur. Those corporate kickers during that 16-year period are concentrated in the 90s. So I won't mention who was doing the forecasting then, but they're concentrated in the 90s. And they, if you go to a shorter time period, which I think it's probably more consistent with the projections you heard today from the Office of Economic Analysis, is less frequent. Basically, two of the last seven biennia, it's triggered. But you still have an average of $100 million per biennium. But, of course, that's dominated by that 05-07 large kicker. By the way, in calculating these, I adjusted for all legislative changes. So there were times when the kicker was suspended. There were times when it was modified through legislative actions. I took the excess revenue absent that policy change. So assuming that wouldn't be very accurate to what will happen in the future.
And if I could, Madam Chair.
Please, Mr. Chair.
Those numbers or averages you've given us, most likely it would happen all at once.
Yes. Yeah. Those are expected values.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, you would get them in lump sums, and particularly you've seen the charts on the patterns for corporate income tax revenue. It's very, very unpredictable. The standard deviation on our projections is over 30% on the corporate income tax.
30%.
34, if I remember right.
And that's true of most states.
And if I could, most of the time when we have a kicker, that would be a great time to understand that we're about to have to batten down the hatches because our revenue is about to fall off the cliff.
Correct.
That, which is what has actually happened pretty much every time in the past.
The last paragraph I have there just addressing with the dollars actually going to K-12. The Constitution is pretty clear that this increment should go to K-12. The issue would be what would be the net effect on the K-12 budget. Would it be an increase of exactly the amount of what the corporate kicker calculation would be versus what it would be without the constitutional provision? That's really impossible to say. And as you know, when the budget process goes through, a lot of factors weigh in on what the budget is. Analogous provision that we had was in Measure 5, which at the time Measure 5 passed, the state was paying for about 30% of school operating costs through the old school operating fund. The Measure 5 required a 6% increase during the phase-in of Measure 5, but of course the state was already spending 30%, so there was a, you know, there was this issue of what base do you use from that 6% calculation. So a similar kind of thing would come in here in terms of how this would be implemented over the long term.
Challenging times. Okay, questions from the committee? Okay, well, I think that completes our agenda. I just want to point out that we don't have paper copies. We are lurching our way into the information age, so the exhibits will be available on our committee webpage for anyone who wants any of the exhibits that we've talked about today.
And Madam Chair, and those, and I should have mentioned this at the beginning, for example, the forecast material was available at the time the gavel goes down. So people will have that during the committee hearing, and that's our goal as we go ahead to try to reduce our costs of copying and so forth. So we would appreciate it. I mean, if it does create problems, if people let us know, but that's kind of our goal. So the other issue is that you your December legislative days are coming up. You have meetings on December 11 and 12, House on 11, Senate on the 12th. So a separate meeting, and you both committees have drawn the 8 o'clock shift.
The early shift.
Yeah. That's good news for the House, not so good for the Senate. Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of announcements, if I might. Well, one announcement and one request. If we're going to go paperless, it would be really useful if the agenda included the URL where the paperless documents can be found, just as a regular thing for the future reference. Mm-hmm. The announcement is that Representative Berger, Co-Chair Berger, and I have agreed that we will continue the practice that we've been using of introducing bills related to revenue, and that will occur toward the end of the meeting on December 11th. So those who have, for whom someone has requested the draft of a revenue bill, that would be one avenue for getting it introduced for early introduction for first reading on opening day.
Okay, and the Senate will also be doing bill introduction on September 12th. We haven't really discussed
December.
December, not September.
Did I say September?
You did.
See, what happens is Dr. Warner and I were discussing when we get colds, our IQ goes down 50 points. And in my case, that puts me in negative territory.
That's why you have me.
That's why. So I will discuss this with my brand new vice chair, and we'll see what we'll do about other revenue bill requests. Okay, is there any other business of the committee? We are adjourned for the Senate.
And the House Revenue Committee is adjourned.
Bye, Dr.